Welcome back to the Book Club. I'm Michael Knowles, and this month we are taking on one of the most controversial books of the 20th century, a book that is loved and despised by all sorts of people, by the left, by the right. And to do that, we will be here with my friend Andy Puzder, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a senior fellow at Pepperdine School of Public Policy, a wonderful advisory member of the board of PragerU, perhaps you've heard of it, and most fun of all, the former CEO of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's. Andy, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
You picked up this book around the time that I first picked up this book, around the time that pretty much everybody first picks up this book, as a young man, as a teenager, and you love it.
Yeah, I read the book and I had found my people. You know, it was like, thank God for this book. I wonder where was this all my life? I picked it up as a first year of college, which distracted me from my studies because I couldn't put the book down. It's such a great book.
So before we get into its meaning and its controversy and why it's still selling a zillion copies today, what's it about?
It came out in 1943. It was by Ayn Rand, who it was her first major literary success. This was a book that really kind of made her name. And it set forth her belief in the creative power of individualism versus the destructive power of collectivism. And this is something that she understood pretty well. She was born in 1905 in Russia. She was 12 years old when the Bolshevik Revolution happened. Her family was pretty well-to-do. They lived in St. Petersburg. They had to leave town. They went down and spent a couple years in the Crimea, which the White Army controlled at the time. That was the Tsar's army. They ended up going back up to St. Petersburg, which became Petrograd, and really lived under very difficult circumstances. They had no money and there was no food. It was a very bad time to be in the now Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics. She got into Leningrad State University, graduated with a degree in history in 1924, and then 1926 came to the United States. So I'd say her teen years and the beginning of her adult life, she lived under the horrendous totalitarian, collectivist, communist regime of Vladimir Lenin in the Soviet Union. So when she talks about collectivism, it's not like people who talk about socialism today and then you ask them what it means and they have no idea. This woman understood collectivism because she lived in under it. To understand the novel, I think the best way to approach it would be maybe to talk about the five major characters in the novel, because that kind of ties it together. The protagonist, the number one character in the book, is a guy named Howard Roark, who's a brilliant young architect who refuses to compromise with the architectural establishment at the time, which opposed innovation. He embodies what Rand considered man as man should be, somebody who was very much a supporter of creativity and individualism, and very much an adamant opponent of collectivism and conformity. And not just in the political sense. It's not just like, you know, capitalism versus socialism or democracy versus communism, but as part of his soul. He's an individualist, a creative individualist, as part of who he is. And through the entire book, he fights what he calls the second-handers, which are people that put conformity above independence, which takes us to the second character that's kind of primary to the book, an individual named Peter Keating, who embodied what Rand thought man should not be. He was he and Roark met each other in architecture school. Roark got out and was independent and not very successful. Peter Keating got out and imitated architectural styles from the past. So he used the architectural styles of the Greeks and the Romans, you know, centuries old architectural styles that were accepted as the best there ever could be. Nobody thought you could improve on them. And he became very successful doing that. But the interesting thing is that whenever he had a problem with a project, a difficulty trying to get some project through, he had to go to Roark and get advice as to how he would do that. The third character I would say is important is Gail Winand. He was a publishing, a media mogul. And he was the man who should have been, but wasn't. He started out as an individualist, but then he surrenders. He surrenders to popular culture. He becomes a tabloid publisher and makes a fortune being a tabloid publisher, but deserted his individuality, deserted his what he really was meant to be. Now, he and Rorick become very close friends, very good buddies. And but when Rorick is attacked, and Winant tries to bring public opinion to favor Rorick, he fails. Public opinion is too adamantly against Rorick. And then he denounces Rorick. He denounces his friend, just like he gave up on his individuality personally. The next character is really fascinating. His name's Ellsworth Toohey. And he's
villain.
Yeah, he's the antagonist. He is a socialist and an architect critic. And he actually writes for Gail Winant's paper. His tabloid in New York is The Banner. And he's the man that never could be and knew it. And so he tries to drag others down. He tries to take people that would excel and drag them down to the level of the common man, common woman. He tries to characterize talent and ability as meaningless unless they're used to meet the needs of the masses, to satisfy popular culture. And if you're trying to achieve your own goals or your own ambitions, then you're not a good guy. And he uses every tool at his disposal to try and destroy Howard Rorick, who he sees as a real challenge to what he's trying to advocate, this collectivist socialist society. And he tries to use his columns in The Banner to convince the public as to what they should be, what their goals should be, like what they should respect. So he tries to guide public opinion, but doesn't want any of the individuals who might be moving society forward to be able to do so. The last character that's important is Dominique Franken, who's like the perfect woman for Howard Rorick. Now, she ends up being his lover, but strangely enough, she also ends up married to Peter Keating for a while and Gail Winant for a while.
But then she goes back and ends up
with Howard Rorick. But she despises society. She despises popular culture. She despises mediocrity. But she thinks individualism has lost. She thinks collectivism is won. Collectivism has conquered the country. And she doesn't like to see Howard Rorick, this individualist, hurt when society rejects him. And she doesn't think society deserves his buildings. So she often works with Toohey to try and hold Rorick back. And then she'll alternate and she'll try and help Rorick because she actually loves Howard Rorick. Now, Rorick ends up designing a public housing project. This is in 1930, so during the Depression. And public housing was very, very expensive. Hard to come up with something where people could live inexpensively. Rorick designed something, kind of in his spare time. He works on this project. Peter Keating gets a government contract to build public housing, but he can't figure out how to do it and come in economically. So he goes to Rorick. Rorick says, I've got these plans. I can do this for you. But the deal is you can be under your name, but you have to sign an agreement that you will not change my design.
You will not change one jot or tittle.
You can't change a thing in the design. He then goes off on a cruise with Gail Winant because Rorick needed a break. He'd been working intensely for decades. And Peter Keating, of course, doesn't keep his word. He changes the building. Rorick comes back and sees it and considers it an abomination and dynamites it, destroys the building, dynamites it, and gets accused of a crime. He goes to court. They want to put him in jail. He'd rather see the thing destroyed and spend the time in jail than let it exist as it existed. And he defends himself in court, doesn't call any witnesses, but gives this really compelling, tremendous speech to the jury where he defends the importance of individualism against the corrupt collectivist societies that have grown up around the world. And the jury acquits him. Now, I wish that high school students for the past 20, 30 years had just read the jury speech, because I think we would not be facing many of the problems we are with younger people if they had read it. If we implemented it today and people had to read it, you know, as mandatory reading today going forward, I think we'd have a much brighter future. It really was an incredible speech and kind of summarizes the ideals in the book.
That was an excellent and pithy summary for a book that is a bazillion pages long in size 3 font, basically.
Well, thank you. I hope I didn't miss anything.
Now, I've read the book 1.5 times. I read it, obviously, for this PragerU episode. But I picked it up, and I only read half of it in high school because, I don't know, I was a little lazier. I couldn't read as fast or something like that. I found that I liked it more when I was 17 than I do today. And I know this is true of a lot of people. Young people love this book, and then some people, they continue to love the book or they totally turn away from it. And I find there are these moments, as you say, some of these speeches where I think, oh, wow, she really gets that.
Yes.
She really gets that work matters. And work isn't just a way to make some money or to please some people. Work is important in itself. Wow, she gets that. So much of the culture doesn't get it. But Ayn Rand has a problem. And the problem that has attracted a lot of controversy is she is a militant atheist. So can religious people like Ayn Rand?
Yeah, I'm religious and I like Ayn Rand. And matter of fact, there's a group called the Atlas Society. I gave the first speech at their first dinner that they had. This must have been about 10 years ago. And they asked me to speak on how could a religious person like Ayn Rand. And you don't have to like everything about Rand. I mean, you don't have to agree with her on everything. And I think she was more agnostic than devotedly atheist. And that comes out in the book where there are some references to a greater power,
yeah,
which I think she actually did believe in. But you really don't have to believe everything. Yeah, Alice in Wonderland was a political book, right, at the time it came. You have to believe everything in Alice in Wonderland to agree with the political point of the book. And I think that what you get in this book, which I think is important for particularly young people to get from the book, is that the whole world can think you're wrong. And you still might be right.
Yeah.
And that's important to understand. It's an important message because I think I've told you I had my kids read this before I'd let them get a driver's license. They had to read Fountainhead and come back and talk to me about it. But the reason I did that was I wanted them to be able to ask the most important question in human history, and that question is why. When people come to you and say, your friends come and say, we should all go out and do drugs, or we should all vote for Obama, or we should all vote for Trump, what everybody's saying, I want my kids to say why, because I don't want them to think they should do something because everybody else is doing it. That's sort of the collectivist model.
Yeah.
I want them to stand up and say, well, why should at least they're still going to make mistakes, but I want them to think about whether or not they're making mistakes. That is a message you get from this book that. Really is apart from whether she was a believer in God or an atheist or an agnostic. I think that's a message that works no matter what your religious beliefs are. You should always want your kids, and you should always yourself ask why and not get caught up in whatever the popular culture is telling you is right just because popular culture is telling you it's right.
And this is one of the most important themes of the book is integrity. Will you stick by your principles? And you've got characters of varying shades of this. Peter Keating has no principles at all.
Right.
Ellsworth Tui, the socialist critic, he does seem to have principles. His principle seems to be, and we find this out later on in the book, destruction. He wants to destroy. He wants power. So for all of his talk of altruism and for all of his talk of giving away and abnegating the self, what he admits is he wants power over others, as socialists often do. Then you've got the character of Gail Winand, the media mogul, who starts out with integrity, but he compromises and ultimately just gives the people what they want through his tabloid. And it raises this really important observation, which is Gail Winand has everything. He's got money, seems like he's got a lot of power and a lot of influence. But if he can't state his own opinion about architecture, about beauty, about society, what's all the money good for?
As the book goes on, when he deserts Howard Roark, it's really like when he deserted his individuality, his principles, his integrity early in the book. He now deserts his integrity again, and it destroys him.
Yeah,
I mean, he never recovers for the rest of the book. And I'd imagine if he were a real-life character, would never have recovered the rest of his life. I mean, this really destroys him. And he says in the book, he says, I other people I can excuse, but I wasn't meant to be a second-hander, and I was. Hmm. And so he can't excuse himself when he steps back from that. So that's, I think that's that's a very important point with respect to the book.
Now, you know, Andy, this is a family show. We try to keep things relatively clean, and yet we can't move past. It's a novel. There's a romance here. There's a lot of sex talk in the book, and Ayn Rand's view on sex is probably fairly scandalous to a lot of people. The first moment when Howard Roark and Dominique, who he ends up with, but she's got some marriages in the middle, and the first encounter that they have, Dominique herself describes as a rape.
Yes.
But she likes it. She loves him. This is a theme that recurs in some of Ayn Rand's writings. It's a little weird. What do we make of that?
I wish it weren't in the book. You know, if I had been editing her, I would have edited that scene out.
Good luck editing Ayn Rand.
Yeah, I know. I don't think it was necessary to the book. And like I said, you don't have to love everything about a book to appreciate the really great message in the book. So that's a part that I'm not going to defend that. I don't. That's not something that that I think should have been in it.
I do wonder though. Ayn Rand described her philosophy as a philosophy around the virtue of selfishness, and has another book, which if you don't want to read 700 pages, you can read a much shorter nonfiction book called The Virtue of Selfishness by Rand. And you can tell in all of her writings, she is reacting against an intimate experience of Soviet communism, which is supposed to be about giving yourself up for everybody else in the world. And she says, no, that's terrible. And so she goes in completely the other direction, or at least seemingly in the other direction, toward an exaltation of selfishness. Even in the sexual encounters, it's always these characters saying, well, I'm not doing this for you, I'm doing this for me. The way that I love you is by loving me and pursuing my interests. And this is hard for people to square with Christianity or with traditional morals, which say, no, we should be charitable, we should love other people. And it's an unsettled question, I think, in her book. How do you resolve it?
Well, I think what she's trying to get at, and it's hard, it's hard because she does use the language you've talked about the virtues of selfishness, and we've even got Milton Friedman at one time saying that, that he didn't say greed is good. That's what that's what Michael Douglas's character said in Wall Street, right, Gordon Gekko. But I think their point is if you look at a character like Ellsworth Toohey, as much as he espouses that he's doing good for other people, nothing that he does ever results in any good. Hmm. But if you look at Howard Roark, who says, "I'm doing this for myself. Yeah. I'm designing these buildings because this is what moves me." But people benefit from that. Think about Henry Ford. Henry Ford was an individualist.
Yeah.
Came up with a way to make cars for the common man and the common woman. Now he didn't do that with the objective that he was going to go out and do something altruistic for people. But what an incredible benefit to everyone. And it's the same with Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs, Ford didn't come up with those cars for kings and queens. He came up with those cars for the common man and the common woman. Steve Jobs came up with these smart devices, not for government elites, but he came up with them for you and for me. Or a guy like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, who comes up with this incredible distribution system. They didn't, he was in there working for himself, trying to, to create wealth and improve his life and make a profit. But God, what a tremendous benefit for all the rest of society. So it is I guess that's the virtue of selfishness. If it's used in that manner, it really is more like altruism than it is like selfishness, because you're really helping a tremendous number of people. I think she probably rolled over in her grave when I said it was like altruism, because that's something that Rand was not particularly in favor of. But I think look, the only way you improve your life in a capitalist society, and she was a capitalist, is by meeting the needs of other people.
Yeah.
And that's different than a socialist society like she was used to, where the way you improve your life is by satisfying the needs of those in power. And if you satisfy the needs of those in power, you share in the very little wealth that's created. Like, you know, in Cuba. Castro had like 20 houses and a yacht. The whole country lives in poverty. Or Kim Jong-un in North Korea doesn't look like he's missed a meal. The country's starving, right? So you really have these communist leaders, these socialist leaders that produce societies where everybody suffers. Right. On the other hand, you go to a capitalist country, and the way that people succeed is by meeting other people's needs, by producing the goods or the services that people want at a price they can afford. That's how you profit. That's how you improve your life. And these incredible individualists, these incredible creative minds, benefit society tremendously. You know, it's a, you know, Jeff Bezos didn't become the richest man in the world because he stole from us. He became the richest man in the world because he provided us with tremendous benefits. So I think in that sense, I don't think she was right to use the word selfishness, but I do see what she means with selfishness can be a virtue because it benefits others.
And to your point, though she might roll in her grave on this, what it seems she's grasping at is not an indictment of charity, but an indictment of dishonesty and an indictment of deception. These people who say, oh, I'm the greatest, most charitable man to all the world, they don't give a whit about anyone else.
Right. They claim they're living for other people, but they're really not doing very much. Now, there are people who do sincerely live for other people. They're saying, you know, Mother Teresa. I mean, there are examples in the world. They're rare. But these people that claim to be doing that as a means to gain power, to influence those in power, or as with Ellsworth Tui, to destroy.
Right.
And boy, you want to talk about the relevance of a book today.
Yeah.
You know, you look around, it's a little hard to deny that somebody's out there trying to destroy the greatness of this country, the greatness of the influence individualism and the right to happiness has had on this country. You know, our Declaration of Independence doesn't talk about the obligation to meet the needs of other people. It talks about your individual right to happiness, right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are individual rights. Those aren't collectivist rights. And it's created the greatest economy in the history of the world. It's lifted billions of people out of poverty. So it's you have to be careful with your words, but I get what she meant.
And she gives it away a little bit at the end when Rourke, after having a difficult career because he won't compromise on his ideals and his principles, he says to this mediocrity, Peter Keating, he says, okay, I'll design your building for you. And you don't need to give me one red cent. You don't need to pay me. So on the one hand, you have Ayn Rand, the arch capitalist. Everything's got a price. She loves price in Atlas Shrugged. The money speech is probably the most famous part of that whole book. Yep. She had a dollar sign of flowers at her funeral. But then at the climax, or one of the climaxes of Fountainhead, the protagonist says, I don't need the money. I need my work to be built.
Yes. Yeah, he's, like I said, he's man as man should be, the man in Rand's mind, totally devoted to creativity and individualism and the power of creativity. And so I'm not surprised by that, but your point is well taken.
Yes.
I mean, she definitely was a capitalist and had a high regard for money as, you know, people say, money is the root of all evil. Well, I think Rand would say that man is the root of all money. That money is just a means of exchange. If you're looking for the evil, don't look for the means of exchange. Look at the people behind it.
And you know, when people say this money is the root of all evil, they're forgetting the first part of the sentence, which is the love of money is the root of all evil.
Good point.
And even Rourke, he's not in it for the money. He likes money. We all like money. Yeah. It's good to be paid for your work. But he's in it for something deeper.
And he will design, I don't know, convenience stores, gas stations. He'll design anything if he's given the challenge to do it, because that's the creative in him. That's the individual in him that just wants to meet that creative need. And that's, by the way, what Dominique doesn't understand.
Yeah,
she thinks he has to satisfy society. He has to get the accolades you get from doing this, and he just doesn't care. And for much of the book is her trying to come to grips with the fact that he just doesn't care. You know, this is what he wants to do, and society really can't hurt him unless they take away his ability to build those buildings. And even if they do, even when they take it away, he just goes and works in a quarry.
Yeah.
You know, he goes and works in a rock. And he, as long as he's doing the work and enjoying it and you know, he was fine with it.
Right.
He resented it. He just didn't have the architecture work that he loved.
You know, Ayn Rand said she wrote Atlas Shrugged, which comes after Fountainhead, because she felt people didn't grasp her meaning in Fountainhead. Yeah. And the books are very similar, and you see similarities in the characters, but they do have different endings. You know, the ending of Atlas is a little more catastrophic than the ending of Fountainhead, which basically wraps up in a happy enough way with the acquittal of Howard Roark for his trial, because he makes this speech.
And he builds this tallest skyscraper in the world for Gail Wine, and actually hires him to go and build this great, but he won't talk to him. So, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to see you. I don't have anything to do with you, but I want you to build the most incredible skyscraper that the city's ever seen. The problem is, you know, that that Toohey kind of took the Howard Roark victory in stride. He had to look for a new job because Winant ends up shutting the Banner down in disgust, I think, with himself. But Toohey went to another newspaper, and the first thing he asked was information on the person that owned it, because he wanted to try and take that over. So Ronald Reagan was like this. I mean, Ronald Reagan, you know, at the end of the Reagan administration, I mean, we all thought it was over. I mean, we had proven socialism just doesn't work.
The Berlin Wall on the brink of collapse.
And we didn't defeat the Soviet Union militarily. We defeated them economically. Our economic system destroyed them. I mean, their economic system just didn't work. If people can't improve their lives through what they're doing, they're not going to work very hard to try and improve their lives. And you know, in our system, you can do that, and we produce much greater wealth. But the problem is that after Reagan left office, and we had proven you know, once and for all that socialism was a system that just didn't work, couldn't work as well as capitalism, all of the Western democracies seemed to have decided that what they needed to do was adopt some of the policies from the economic system we just defeated, which, you know, like that was the smart thing to do. And here we are again, having to prove that that our system is far superior to the socialist system, and young people aren't you know, they're sort of not getting it. And I speak to a lot of youth groups, and when you ask, people will say, you know, well, I'm a socialist, and I hear what you're saying, but I'm still a socialist. And then I'll just say, well, so what is a socialist? When you say you're a socialist, what exactly do you mean? They have no idea.
It means I'm a good person. Yeah.
I had one where this young lady said she was a socialist. I said, well, that's great. It was a small group, like 30 people. I said, maybe you can define for the rest of us what socialism is. And she gave some answer that made absolutely no sense. It's like good people and nice people, everybody treats. I said, well, would you agree with this? Socialism is a system where the people decide what direction the economy goes in. It's the people who decide what happens in the economy, and that capitalism is a system where there's a group of elites who make the decisions as to what happens in the economy. And she said, yeah, that's a great definition. I said, well, it's just the opposite. I said, in fact, capitalism, you vote with every dollar you spend as to what, you know, whether it's an iPhone or an Android, or if you're old enough to remember, a BlackBerry. You know, these products, what succeeds and fails depends upon your vote with every dollar you spend. I said, in a socialist economy, you have to please the people who control the economy, which are the elites. So it's really just the opposite, which I don't know if I got through to her. She seemed kind of stunned.
Well, but this is the question then for these younger people who have fallen away from good old traditional American values. And you look around the state of the country and the world, seems we may have squandered some of that victory in the Cold War.
Yeah.
Which ending is more likely, the Atlas Shrugged ending, where you see the society effectively collapse, or the Fountainhead ending, where things kind of work out and the people even decide to acquit Howard Roark? They actually are sort of won over to Roark's side. Ayn Rand is criticized for her characters being a little too stiff. You know, they don't seem realistic. They're all, and it's just the style of writing. They're meant to represent ideas. But is that happy ending likely? Will the people actually come around?
I would say two things. One is Dickens' characters were like that too. There was no real Little Nell. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, there's, you know,
even Scrooge.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the way you get your messages across in these novels, and the characters are very distinct. I mean, you really, that's why I described the book by going through the characters. I don't know. If you asked me this 10 years ago, I probably would have given you, let me see, 2000, maybe if you asked it about 15 years ago, I probably would have given you a different answer than I'd give today. Reagan, not to overquote Reagan, but Reagan, President Reagan said that freedom is always but one generation away from extinction. And when you lose it, it's not going to come back anytime soon. I've been real concerned about that over the past 10 years. It's why I've done a lot of speaking at colleges and really to any youth groups that I can, because I'm afraid that our education system has deteriorated to the point where young people really aren't getting good exposure to what made this country great and what's in their best interest or what economic system. Like I said, if Barack Obama said in 2015 that capitalism, nobody disputes. He says, let me take it back. He said, we do not dispute that capitalism is the greatest economic system in history. It's created more wealth than any other system, and it has lifted billions of people out of poverty. Well, sounds like a pretty good system. I mean, how many kids do you think are hearing that in high schools today? In Colorado, they just the teachers union just came out with some very strange statement about they weren't going to teach capitalism anymore because it was too oppressive. And the kids in Colorado are going to hear about how billions of people have been lifted out of poverty. So I think that I'm concerned with this generation. I'm concerned that we may be dealing with a generation that will lose the freedom that we've fought so hard to preserve. So I think everybody who understands what we have and understands the value and the significance of capitalism in particular has an obligation to go out there and start speaking up, because kids aren't going to get this in school. That's why you see so many people homeschooling. Used to be I'd speak to a group, and afterwards I always asked them to say what college or where they're from. And it used to be maybe, 5% were homeschooled. Now I'm getting like 40, 50%. Right. I mean, a lot of kids are homeschooled because I think parents don't feel that the kids are getting the education they should get in the public schools.
Right, of course. So I suppose it seems like at once a collapse of an order, but also maybe a glimmer of hope. And I suppose that's what Ayn Rand is reaching for too, which is at the end of these novels, both of them, Atlas and Fountainhead, she says, things are not looking great and there are all sorts of reasons to be quite pessimistic about the way that society is run. But as long as there's you, as long as there's that one Howard Roark, as long as there's that one Dominique Francone, as long as there's this one, there's a chance that this ideal of the human spirit will remain. And so while her novels are all about ideals, this one in particular is so uncompromising on these ideals. Think like, the ideals will endure even if the flesh and blood society crumbles.
When you think of Elon Musk, I mean, sometimes one individual can stand up to this collectivist mentality and make a difference. And I think he is making, I don't agree with everything that Elon Musk believes, but I think he's trying to stand up and make a difference. I think he's trying to defend these values. I think it's funny how immigrants appreciate this much more than people that have grown up in the United States, like Rand and like Musk. Hmm. You really see the impact that one person speaking up, one person acting, one person sticking to their ideals and their values can make a difference, even against a massive public reaction against them, much as Roark experienced.
Right.
I think I told you I had one son who read Roark's speech to the driver. He's had to get his driver's license, so. And he comes down with his finger in a book like this big where the speech, and my wife and I are watching TV, and he's now 30, 31, it'd be 15 years ago. He came down and he's got his finger, he goes, Dad, where did this come from? Like, why haven't I ever heard, they don't teach this in school. Why haven't I ever heard this before? Like, why don't people know about this?
Right.
And I remember looking at my wife and saying, this one will be okay.
Yeah. What's so important about that observation, too, is, and it's one thing I really like about Ayn Rand and about Fountainhead in particular, is it's a book about architecture. It's a book about building. It's a book about the relation between ideas and the real world that we're all walking around in. These are not ideas that just float around in outer space and fade away, but the ideas that we hold and that we pursue are going to be built up, even physically, all around us, which is, by the way, the very point of this show, is to recognize that these ideas will have a real instantiation in the world. So we've got to make sure that we get them right.
They're like the skyscrapers in New York, which was her point. When you stand at the bottom one of those, Rorick, people think this is intimidating. Rorick and Dominique Franken think man built this. You know, it's a different perspective,
right.
And it's one that I wish more young people were exposed to today. And I really appreciate you doing that on this show, because young people do pay attention to what happens at PragerU, and we need to find ways to reach these people.
And we'll see what kind of buildings go up as a result. Andy, thank you for being on.
Michael, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into the Book Club. As always, I'm Michael Knowles. See you next month. Thank you so much for watching this episode of the Book Club on PragerU. PragerU is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so we rely on donations from viewers like you to keep this content on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution today to help keep this content coming. Thank you very much.